Hello and welcome to another episode of eDiscovery Chicks, the podcast about all things eDiscovery and legal tech, hosted by two gals who are excited to embrace their wilder side in this episode. Anyways, we're your hosts. That's Bree.
And that's Angie. And today we're talking about the Idaho murders. You know, in November 2022, there was a murder of four University of Idaho students in which Brian Koberger, a PhD criminology student at Washington State University, was eventually arrested and charged. But before we get to that topic, my goodness, Angie, I'm so excited. Allison Dowd and Jennifer Salvadori stopped by with the Techno Security Conference. So, hey, ladies, it's nice to have you.
Hi, how are you?
Great to be here.
Great. Well, I was hoping that you could tell us a little bit about the Techno Security Conference because Angie and I have spoken there in the past, and I've spoken for this will be my third year to speak at the conference, and I'm so excited. We've got Techno West and Techno East. Talk to us a little bit about what the conference is.
Well, I'll get started and dive right into that. For those of you that don't know, this is our 26th year. Hard to believe. Wow. Allison and I have been around for almost 10 years now. But the conference was started by a couple of three-letter agency guys. Most people remember it from being Techno Myrtle Beach. Happens every year, first week of June. And the focus was originally computer forensics. And when cell phones came out, had a big shift over to the mobile forensics side. And we blended in a little cyber, I don't know, 5-6 years ago. And then most recently, eDiscovery, which has brought us to you now.
So. Yay.
And we're so glad that you decided to incorporate eDiscovery. Otherwise, Bree and I wouldn't be enmeshed with you all right now. And you're too much fun for that.
We do like to have fun. We work hard, play hard, I think you know.
Always have a good time with you ladies.
Okay, so can you tell us a little bit more about, like, what are the topics that get discussed at Techno East and Techno West? And what can folks who attend the conference expect to learn?
Yeah, I'll take that one, Jen. Yeah, so Techno East, we have over 120 sessions. And Techno East takes place just in a few weeks, June 3rd through the 5th in Wilmington, North Carolina. Techno West is in October 27th through the 29th out in San Diego. But on Techno East, like I said, we have 120 topics and we have a dedicated eDiscovery track. And some of the topics there are talking about deepfakes, hyperlinked documents. Obviously, there's a lot of talk about AI. And then we have a couple of sessions on mobile forensic tools for eDiscovery. So a lot of interesting topics, talking about new tools that work for eDiscovery and digital forensics, and just a great array of speakers that are coming there to speak like you all.
Well, I'm excited to be there at Techno East. I mean, that's going to be a great week. I was there the last couple of years, and it's always a fun time gathering with a lot of forensic people, but also eDiscovery, like you said. There's also legal ops, like you said. What made you guys excited to include eDiscovery along with the traditional forensics conference? What was the reason for that?
I would say the overlap. I mean, there's so much overlap in technologies and the things that you do, the data carving, keyword search, metadata analytics, and now, of course, AI. It just made sense, the continuum from a case being created and all the way to closure. It's part of that continuum. We started to see a lot more analysts, folks from district attorney's offices. Investigators have to understand a lot more. You know, I always say it's like A to Z. If your job's A to Z, you need to know what happens in the middle before you and after you to better do your own job. So it just made sense. It's been, what, 3 years now, Al? Blended it?
Yeah, 3 years.
Yeah, I love that. And Angie and I are always talking about cross-collaboration as part of our common themes of our podcast. Because it's great career growth for everyone who's in eDiscovery to branch into forensics and vice versa. It helps you have a little bit more of a holistic viewpoint and perspective.
Absolutely.
Definitely.
Yeah. One of the things that I loved about this conference is it feels like it brings people from all different walks of life. Like you've got the hardcore like forensic nerds, you've got the tech geeks, you've got the law geeks, you've got people that have specialized in various aspects of forensics as the field has really grown. And so to me, it always felt like this very diverse, very fun kind of group of people that just want to learn more about this topic. So that's why I think you can't miss this conference. But Allison, Jennifer, Bree, what are your thoughts? Why should people go? Why must they not miss this incredible opportunity?
So you will learn so much in these sessions. We have the top people speaking in the different industries and not only learn from them, but have really meaningful conversations with them, whether it's during the actual sessions, in the hallway, at lunch, at the bar, at dinners. You are going to talk to so many people that you most likely won't run into at other conferences because, like you said, Angie, we bring all these different sectors together, whether it's law enforcement, private sector, attorney generals, prosecutors, investigators, and they're all there to learn. And you will pick up little bits of knowledge throughout your conversations and meet people and realize, hey, that person has the same problem or I can help you with that problem. And it really is a true community. And I know a lot of events say that, but we are not a huge event. We're about 900 people and we just are pretty tight. I mean, people are there to learn. They're there to hear from each other and just mix and socialize and really connect.
Yeah, it really is a cool community. It's a blend. It's a very cool blend of the public sector and the private sector. A lot of former military coming out, you know, career people in federal agencies. There's just so much overlap. You know, we work with folks like you at eDiscovery Tips. We also work with other industry partners in eDiscovery specifically. Women in eDiscovery is on board working with us to help spread the message, the Association of Certified eDiscovery Specialists. So it's those tendrils that kind of cross paths. You can meet somebody at Techno. You may not have the same information in your workspace that they have, but down the road, you may have a question. You can reach out to that person that you met. If they don't have the answer, they'll send you to 5 other people that they met at the conference. We're very accessible. I think the community will see Allison and I out everywhere. And we love to make it happen. We love to connect people. That's what we do best. And I hope you all can join us.
It's one of the things that I first fell in love with, just the intimate feeling of the conference. It's easy when you go to these conferences to kind of get lost and not really feel like you have a voice or you're heard or you don't have a chance to network or connect. And that is not the case with Techno Security at all. Both the West and the East have been very positive and just very enlightening experiences for me. I know Angie and I have actually met people that we've asked to be on the podcast because we were just been so enamored with the information that we're learning. I appreciate you, Jennifer and Allison, for making it such a great environment that kind of feels like family in a way. As we get ready for Techno East, I'm wondering, what is your favorite thing about going to Wilmington, Allison and Jennifer?
It's always about seeing the people, right? But Wilmington in particular, the nightlife there, I love to see that everyone can just kind of cut loose a little bit. You don't have to worry that something you're going to do in the off hours is going to end up anywhere on social media. It's that ability to just kind of see everyone relax. Everyone that works with such sensitive and delicate topics. You know, we have a lot of ICAC folks and human trafficking investigators and obviously prosecutors. To just see that camaraderie amongst people who have a shared common mission. It's bigger in East because the East is a much bigger conference. It's been around so much longer.
Yeah. Allison, do you have anything that you want to mention?
I have to say, I mean, Wilmington is a really cool city. If you haven't been there, it's not a big city, but it has a lot going on. Like Jen mentioned, there's a lot of bars, a lot of restaurants, a lot of historic sites. We're right on the river. It's beautiful to walk around and just check out the architecture. It's really close to the beaches. So it's a small city, but it has a lot of trendy restaurants, a good music scene. So when you're done with a conference learning and you just want to hang out with your coworkers or other Techno attendees, it's a really fun atmosphere.
Thank you guys for popping in and letting us know a little bit about the Techno Security Conference and in terms of the history, but also, you know, giving us a little sneak peek at what we can expect in Wilmington this June. And I will be there and I will be speaking. So I look forward to seeing anyone that wants to join in, and it's sure to be a great time. And in case anybody missed it, that's going to be Techno Security Digital Forensics Conference East in Wilmington, North Carolina on June 3rd through 5th at the Wilmington Conference Center. If you want more information on it, of course, you can find it on our LinkedIn site, but you could also go to www.technosecurity.us. Thank you, Allison and Jennifer, for stopping by today.
Thank you both.
We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
How are you doing, Angie?
Well, I'm doing pretty well. And one of the reasons is a little bit cruel. And it's because my husband went to Washington State University. And so I just get to make fun of him endlessly for his school having produced this serial killer, to which he will almost certainly respond, "Okay, Ted Bundy, because I went to University of Washington. Washington's a really murdery place. I don't know what to tell you.
But why? I mean,
I don't know.
There's plenty of murders in Houston, Texas, and our surrounding areas. We got our own issues, but I can understand it's the heat that drives everybody crazy. No,
yeah, something. Maybe it's weather-based. Like us, it's the rain. You, it's the heat. Who knows?
I don't know. Well, I'm excited that we are revisiting our foul play series. You know, if you've been following along earlier this year, we started some subject matter that's more, it's more criminal. It's a more forensic than what we've done in the past. But truly, these topics do have a lot to do with e-discovery. And so we hope to explore that today. But Angie, there was a poll on the eDiscovery Chicks LinkedIn recently asking if we should continue these or stick to what we know.
I'm sorry. I did draft it that way. That was really self-deprecating of me.
It was like, that's rude.
It was me. I was rude to myself. Yeah, I was surprised. Well, we got like really, really favorable feedback for this series, this foul play series. And so here we are. Diving in again, tackling another murder. Last time was BTK. Mm-hmm. We've also done an episode on deepfakes. We've done an episode on cell tower triangulation data. So we're just forging ahead.
Yeah. And as much as people might want to quote unquote stick to what you know, there is a lot of overlapping resources and tools and overlapping workflows that go into this. So I think it's very relevant. So we'll see. I think it was like 88% said to keep going. And then there was like the 12 little whiners. No, I'm just kidding.
I love that you keep shitting on these, like you keep dunking on these people, but I'm the one who wrote the poll that way.
You did it to us. They're like, oh, this is like a cool option. Like you fell into the trap, bros. Like you're supposed to all say, no, I'm just kidding.
They might have just been like, we prefer the more sanitized content. And Bree's over here dunking on them like, they hate us and they know nothing.
I'm just happy that somebody cared enough to answer our poll, whether I like the response or not. It was very nice to get some feedback. So that's what I should say. I'll say that today, before we go any further, there is a trigger warning. This episode will contain brief allusions to and descriptions of murder and violence. If these topics are disturbing to you, we encourage you to exercise your best judgment about whether this is the right episode for you.
So, the case. Here's what happened. In the early hours of November 13th, 2022, in the quiet college town of Moscow, Idaho. Now, I know that's confusing because we mentioned Washington State University before, but those two are actually very close. I think like 10 miles apart. In the early morning hours of November 13th, 2022, four University of Idaho students were found brutally murdered in their off-campus house. Their names are Kaylee Gonclaves, Madison Mogan, Zena Kernodle, and Ethan Chapin. All four were stabbed to death. Now, these murders were shocking not only for their brutality, but also for the apparent lack of motive, the lack of eyewitnesses, the lack of a murder weapon, and the total lack of immediate suspects. So let's talk about this house that they lived in. This was a three-story, six-bedroom home. And on the night of the murders, six people were there. The four victims plus two survivors. The two survivors' rooms were in the basement. Two of the victims were on the second floor and two were on the third floor. This house is located in what is considered to be a safe and close-knit community. So a community that quickly became the center of a national media frenzy after this horrendous event took place. Now, law enforcement was initially stumped, even though they were inundated with a deluge of tips, speculation, and public pressure. And the case stalled at first. Now, again, this is partly because there was no apparent motive or any eyewitnesses or any suspects. But in late December, so just over a month after the murders, police announced the arrest of Brian Koberger, a 28-year-old criminology and criminal justice PhD student at Washington State University, or WAZU, if you want to talk shit. So turns out Koberger just lived just 10 miles from the crime scene. And in a super creepy twist, he'd been attending classes and lectures about criminal behavior during the manhunt. And here's the e-discovery part. It wasn't a confession that did Koberger in or even his suspicious behavior. It was actually a digital trail. And one more thing before you jump in, Brie. I am sorry in advance for all the shit talking I do to WAZU. I can't help it. You're my rival school. You're lovely people, except for Koberger, who is not. But I married one, so I feel like that gives me a little bit of a little street cred.
Well, and I'm just going to say, you guys, if you're going to get mad, please get mad at Angie, because I have no skin in this game. If we start talking about Texas, then my little Texas Aggie self will speak right on up. But I have no skin in this game.
I have skin in every Apple Cup game. Other than that, I don't care about football. But Apple Cup, I care about.
Oh, my goodness. Anyways. I don't even know what Apple Cup is, but it sounds like a really good drink.
Yeah, I don't know about that. It's the rivalry football game every year. So that's the one day a year I care about football.
Okay. Well, back to the task at hand. This case has become a blueprint for how digital evidence and e-discovery principles are used in criminal investigations. Specifically, cell phone geolocation data to track movement and patterns, search history and internet activity to infer intent and surveillance, surveillance video and license plate readers to map physical presence, and chain of custody, may or may not be my favorite topic, digital records for DNA and forensic evidence. But that's what we're focused on in this episode, how metadata, digital footprints, and forensic discipline can bring justice to those affected by tragedies like this. On a side note, me and Angie like to joke around just about everything in life. Like, we're a bunch of jokesters.
It's our coping mechanism.
It seriously is. As many jokes as Angie and I like to tell and as silly as we like to get, I do want you to know that not only do our hearts hurt for the tragedy of the families that were affected by this and the people who lost friends, lost, you know, siblings, etc., we also have the utmost respect for our forensic brothers and sisters that are out there in the field performing this work. So as we go along in discussing this topic, I do want to say that there's a lot more to it than what we're going to talk about today. Brian Koberger, by the way, if you start Googling this and researching this, there's a lot of talk about things that he was going through and his behaviors and choices that he made. And that's a topic all to itself. We specifically today are going to be talking about the forensic investigation and how that overlaps into our e-discovery world. And we're also not going to spend a lot of time talking about the victims. We haven't been in contact with any of their families and don't feel like it's our place, but there are a bunch of articles and podcasts out there where the victims' families have been consulted, and we encourage you to turn to those to learn more if you're interested.
Yep. Despite not doing what we do during our day jobs, we are going to try to stay in our lane, which is to focus on the e-discovery aspect of this. And first and foremost to that is how e-discovery and digital forensics played a role in finding and capturing Brian Koberger. Now, one of the first big breaks came from surveillance footage, both from university and city-owned cameras, as well as some private Ring and security cameras at homes near the murder site. Multiple cameras captured a white sedan driving repeatedly around the neighborhood on November 13th. That's the day of the murders. The sedan didn't belong to any of the victims or to any of their friends, which raised some red flags. And investigators used license plate readers and camera footage to trace the car's movements, eventually identifying it as a 2015 white Hyundai Elantra. Now, at this point, they still didn't have a suspect, but the car became a central lead.
Investigators ran a broad search through DMV records in Idaho and Washington. Moscow is close to Washington, by the way, for a white Hyundai Elantra registered to males of a certain age group. Now, y'all are going to be like, well, I'm never going to be looking at any DMV records. You don't know. When I was a paralegal and I used to do investigations, we absolutely looked at records all the time because we're looking for people and places. And we're trying to figure out where they are in jurisdictions. We may have to serve them with a lawsuit. We may have to serve them with a subpoena. We may want to know what they're really up to. All those investigations that you do, this is the kind of activity that we're talking about. We're searching through the DMV, the public records, and we're trying to find little tips that will kind of lead us on a trail. One fact will lead us to the next, the next, the next, until we find what we're looking for.
And why I always keep the wrong address on my driver's license, just in case someone comes looking for me, they're going to wind up at my old house.
I'm like, what address do you have?
For all my clandestine activities.
But that's when Brian Koberger's name surfaced, is through those DMV records. He owned a 2015 white Hyundai Elantra registered in Pennsylvania, but garaged near Pullman, Washington, at Washington State University. Investigators then cross-referenced university databases and learned that Koberger was a PhD student at WSU.
Mm-hmm. So we got some little flags on Mr. Koberger at this point. Next up, law enforcement pivoted to cellular forensics. So once Koberger became a person of interest, investigators turned to his phone. And this is really a staple of modern e-discovery in both civil and criminal matters. And here, in this case, the goal was to create a pattern of life map, where his phone had been, when, and how often.
That's right. And so the first thing that had to happen is you had to secure the data from the cell phone provider. Law enforcement in this case secured a warrant, which they served on Koberger's cell provider. And by the way, if you want more information on this process, please go back to this season, season two, episode one, From Towers to Trials. We did a whole episode about this. The cell provider turned over the Koberger's historical call detail records and cell site location information. These records show which towers a phone connects to at specific times, allowing investigators to estimate a person's location.
Yep, and here, this is what they found. Koberger's phone had connected to towers near the victim's house on at least 12 occasions before the murders. Most of these visits happened late at night or early in the morning. Now, these repeat visits created a trail of digital breadcrumbs, suggesting that Koberger had surveilled the house before committing the murders, maybe to learn his victim's schedules or routines, or just trying to figure out how to get in and out of the house. This geolocation pattern is called a pre-crime behavioral profile. Now, on the night of the murders, Koberger's phone was turned off, maybe in airplane mode or otherwise disabled, from 2:47 a.m. until 4:48 a.m. And guess what else happened during that time?
Dun, dun, dun.
Murders. Now, investigators interpreted this as a deliberate attempt to prevent tracking. A move that, ironically, became more suspicious than if the phone had just been on the whole time. This is also a great example about how the absence of data is data. It's like the dog that didn't bark. The phone had never gone dark like that before, not in the months or in the records that they examined. Now, after the murders, his phone reconnected to cell towers along a route heading back to Pullman, Washington, where he lived.
All right, so let's talk about strategy and a couple of the techniques and theories that all came together to make this happen. Number one, the investigators took the cell phone site location data that they received and they laid it over a map of known surveillance footage and vehicle movements. So they're kind of taking multiple pieces of information to create this triangulation that helped them corroborate multiple lines of evidence. Koberger's phone and car were in the same places at the same time before and after the crime. Coincidence? I think not. His patterns deviated from normal on the night of the murders. That's something that we need to keep in mind, looking for things that are abnormal. This also helps when we're doing internal investigations, like, I don't know, in a corporation. But these deviations were behaviorally meaningful. The proximity to the scene, the digital disappearance during the crime, and the retreat afterwards. They all seem super sus. This is a textbook example of pattern of life analysis where digital movements establish things like routine behavior, anomalies, support for inference of knowledge or intent.
And so I want to take a moment here to talk about direct versus circumstantial evidence. Because in criminal cases, you have two types of evidence, direct and circumstantial. An example of direct evidence is an eyewitness saying something like, I saw so-and-so at the murder scene at 3:30 a.m. Circumstantial evidence, on the other hand, is a little bit more oblique. For example, Koberger's phone didn't ping off any towers during the murders, which differs from his normal behavior pattern. And one thing I want to flag about this is the law weights direct and circumstantial evidence equally, meaning juries are instructed to give equal weight to those two different types of evidence. And cell site data is a circumstantial data powerhouse, because when it's tied to timestamps, location, and other surrounding facts, it can build a narrative of premeditation. Think about how his cell phone pinged near the murder site about a dozen times beforehand. Prosecutors can use that to argue that the frequent visits to the house show more than coincidence. And we couple that with his phone going dark at exactly the right time, which can be presented as consciousness of guilt, a way to avoid detection. That actually backfired here. Now, in cases with no eyewitnesses and no confessions, so this case, this circumstantial data can become the spine of a prosecution's case, and it can be used to show things like intent and also used to rebut innocent explanations.
So let's talk about internet search history and its digital footprint. This is something that, of course, relates to this case. But if you are in a corporation and you're doing internal investigations, these are some ideas and concepts that you would want to be familiar with. So what happened next? Investigators then turned to Koberger's digital footprint, specifically his search history, browsing patterns, and social media activity. They subpoenaed his search engine data, browser history, and social media records. Why? Well, because it can reveal what the target is thinking, the victims, the crime scene, and the act of committing a crime. So search engine data for an individual is collected from platforms like Google or Bing. If you're in a corporation, you might have something like a Zscaler or other type of web logs that also have this information. But it includes things like search queries, the terms that somebody entered into the search bar, like how to dispose of a knife, or timestamps, which is the date and time each search was performed, location history if it's enabled, map searches or GPS inquiries, search session metadata, IP address. Where was he when he performed these searches? What device was he on? And what browser did he use? Clicked search results. What links did the user actually click on when she did run these results? Browser history is something else that would be considered. And this can either be pulled from something like a web log that's being kept, but really in a criminal case involving a person, this is likely to be pulled from a device using a forensic extraction. This would include a full list of visited websites, time spent on each page, what files were downloaded, the cookies, and the session tokens. It's worth noting that when we're looking at search engine data and browser history, these are things that come in very voluminous reports. I remember looking at these in-house when we were doing internal investigations, and they were so data heavy, and there was so much information there that it would have taken a lifetime to review them line by line. So learning to be savvy with these reports and how you cull them, like maybe I want to cull down by certain types of sites or a certain date range, or maybe there's specific keywords I'm looking for. All of those e-discovery practices that we know we use when we're reviewing data and culling through data is the same thing that forensic investigators are doing when they're looking at this search engine data and the browser history. They're trying to tell a story. They're trying to find the motive. They're trying to find behavior patterns. All right, so one other thing that was also reviewed was social media records. These came from platforms like Meta, Instagram, Snapchat, TikTok, or it could be a device extraction again. They would include things like direct messages, DMs, like including the deleted ones that have been archived or tried to be purged from the machine. And sometimes we can even get fragments of something that was purged quite a long time ago. It would also include post history, what public and private posts were posted, what photographs were posted, etc. It would include the search history within the platform, like maybe he's looking up the victim's names or their profiles. It would also include things like interaction logs. Where did he like? What did he comment on? What was he sharing? What was he following? Who was he unfollowing? Basically, investigators are looking at what Koberger searched for, what he read, who he messaged, and what he clicked on, what he deleted, all in conjunction with the timestamps, the geolocation data, etc. This is why I say that AI is not going to replace humans, because the analysis here that's required is quite sophisticated. We've got to look at multiple different places where we're receiving information and pull it all together to tell a story.
And since this case is ongoing, some filings are still under seal, which means we can't access them. They're not publicly accessible. But prosecutors have hinted that Koberger searched the internet for information about the victims and their house. So, think about that. Like, he could have been Googling the layout of the house, looking at victims' social media pages, things like that. And why this matters legally is because it all goes to intent. In a first-degree murder case, the prosecution has to prove intent. And what you do online, what you look up, what you read, what you watch, what you click on, can speak to your state of mind, i.e. your intent. If a suspect is researching how to commit a crime, is tracking a victim, etc., it can show that the crime was planned or deliberated or targeted. And this is where e-discovery becomes so much more than just file collection, because it's about reconstructing someone's mental process.
Metadata establishes a timeline. Timestamps from search history are essential when you're doing these types of investigations. It's not just what he searched, but when. Was he looking up the victims months before the crime? Was he researching police investigative techniques? Metadata allows investigators to sequence digital behavior alongside physical movement, match specific searches to moments when his phone pinged near the victim's house. Spot escalation? Did the searches become more violent or obsessive over time? And also, start turning that flat data set that I'm talking about into a narrative. Was there a progression from curiosity to action?
All right, so let's talk about what digital evidence will probably prove pivotal in this case. First up, Amazon purchase history. In March 2022, so about 8 months before the murders, Koberger bought a knife on Amazon. Now, I have Googled how you're supposed to pronounce this knife. I don't know a lot about knives, so I went to Google. It is either Kabar or K-bar. It's some sort of combat knife and a sheath.
K-bar.
K-bar? Okay.
I think that's right.
Yeah, there were a lot of people on the internet being like, how do you pronounce this? And not a lot of definitive answers. So, okay. So he bought this combat knife and a sheath to go with it. Now, investigators learned this by targeting Koberger's click activity on Amazon, and specifically click activity related to knives and accessories. Remember, the victims were stabbed. Investigators actually found a knife sheath at the crime scene, and wouldn't you know it, it matched the one Koberger bought on Amazon.
And then he does the genius move of the post-murder selfie. Why?
I mean, who wouldn't? If it's not on the gram, it didn't happen.
Oh, my God. At 10:31 a.m. on November 13th, just hours after the murders, Koberg took a selfie in which he's smiling and giving a thumbs up. Ugh. The surviving roommate described the intruder as having bushy eyebrows, a feature that was evident in Koberg's selfie.
One thing I want to flag is something about legal proceedings and admissibility, because the court has denied motions in this case. We haven't had a trial yet. We'll get to that in the end of this episode. But the court has denied various motions to suppress this digital evidence, specifically the evidence gathered from Koberger's Amazon, Google, and Apple accounts, which means it's probably coming in a trial, assuming this case goes to trial.
DNA and forensic correlation. One of the most consequential pieces of evidence in this case was a tan leather knife sheath left behind at the crime scene, like Angie just mentioned. It was branded with the U.S. Marine Corps insignia and matched the style used to carry a K-bar. We're going to go with that pronunciation. Combat knife.
Don't at us.
Yeah,
we're trying.
And don't tell me to stick to my day job, okay? Because I know K-bar knives are not involved, okay? But touch DNA. So forensic analysts recovered a single male DNA profile from the snap button of the sheath, a part probably touched during weapon use or holstering. DNA didn't match anyone in the CODIS database, which is a national DNA database, so they weren't able to immediately identify a suspect. But it was preserved, i.e. extracted, digitized, and stored with metadata for further comparison. It's worth noting that even when someone's DNA doesn't immediately lead investigators directly to a suspect, it can be super valuable corroborating evidence down the road.
And here, that's exactly what happened. Investigators used a public DNA database to run a familial search. From that search, they identified distant relatives of the unknown DNA profile, and then using family tree analysis and cross-referencing with other records like DMV and university records, they narrowed their search to Brian Koberger. Fun fact, this is actually the same method that helped catch the Golden State Killer. But anyway, from there, once they kind of narrowed their search to Brian Koberger, law enforcement had to confirm the match. And so they did a trash pull at Koberger's parents' house in Pennsylvania, where they collected discarded items like tissues or napkins, things like that. Then they extracted DNA from Koberger's dad, which matched the unknown DNA on the sheath with 99.9998% certainty. Now, once Koberger was arrested, a cheek swab confirmed that his DNA was the source of the profile on that snap.
So DNA isn't e-discovery in the traditional sense. We get that. But let's talk about my favorite e-discovery concept. It's chain of custody time. So in handling the DNA, we have to keep in mind several things that are very similar to what you probably heard me talk maybe ad nauseum about in the past regarding chain of custody. From the moment it's collected, it's heavily dependent on digital records and metadata. So chain of custody logs, every moment of the knife sheath swab and the resulting DNA sample is tracked in a digital evidence management system. Systems timestamp every handoff, every analysis, and every custody transfer. Any gap or inconsistency in these logs can lead to evidence being challenged or excluded. otherwise known as admissibility issues.
Whoop, which is my favorite soapbox.
So instrumentation metadata. Forensic tools generate automatic logs of date and time of each test run, calibration records, sample barcodes, technician IDs, etc. Logs ensure that results are repeatable, reliable, and admissible in court. Another type of evidence, laboratory information management systems. These track things like sample intake, storage location, like, I don't know, freezer inventory, testing workflow and result reporting, quality control checks, and flagging of anomalies. Basically, the forensic version of eDiscovery review platforms, structured, auditable, and metadata rich. Chain of custody is the bridge between physical evidence and digital trust. Data generated behind the scenes, like timestamps, logs, user IDs. That's what makes DNA results admissible and credible.
Exactly. So let's talk about where the case stands today. Trial is currently scheduled for August 11th, 2025 in Boise, Idaho. Now, it's Boise, not Moscow, where the murders happened, because the defense team was concerned about the potential local biases in Moscow. This is not abnormal for high-profile cases, especially when they happen in a small town where your jury pool isn't extensive. Now, as far as motive, we still don't have an established motive at this point, and prosecutors haven't publicly stated a clear theory, but some investigative reporting has posited a few. The first one is obsession and voyeurism. Koberger reportedly had an intense academic interest in the psychology of crime, including how criminals think, act, and avoid detection. Also, the kind of second theory that's sort of related to this is a fixation on the victims. There were a number of pings near the victim's house and reports that he followed at least one of the female victims on Instagram. A third theory is that Koberger was experiencing some sort of social rejection / incel adjacent ideologies. Some online sleuths and criminologists have suggested that Koberger may have harbored a resentment towards women that inspired him to commit these murders. And then the final one is just a crime without a conventional motive, or a quote-unquote mission crime, which is someone seeking personal significance or trying to commit the perfect crime. When I was at the prosecutor's office, we actually had a trial go on where this was the purported motive. And I'll never forget this. In the opening statement, the prosecutor who was trying the case said, you know, I can't remember the defendant's name, but like so-and-so was a student of murder. And then they proceeded to show his, you know, search history and things like that, where they highlighted how often he Googled, like, how to commit the perfect murder, how to commit the perfect crime. So that one can actually be pretty compelling and interesting.
It's very interesting and will be interesting to see what happens to this case in trial. So why, you ask yourself, does this even matter for e-discovery professionals? Well, there are several different reasons why we should pay attention. Number one, digital artifacts are circumstantial, but they're persuasive. Digital evidence like search history, location data, and metadata from devices didn't directly show a crime being committed, but it helped build a compelling, circumstantial case that told a story about preparation, movement, intent, and post-crime behavior. Koberger's phone pinged near the crime scene a dozen times before the murders. His search history showed an abnormal interest in this house. His Amazon purchases matched the murder weapon. No one directly saw him commit the crime, but his digital trail paints a pretty incriminatory picture. Also, it's important to keep in mind that defendants can really challenge anything and everything that they want to. Koberger's defense team has already moved to suppress digital evidence, arguing several things. One, they want to claim that the subpoenas were warrantless searches, meaning they didn't get the permission that they needed to actually subpoena the different devices and pieces of evidence that were considered. They also claim that AI-powered algorithms on Amazon may have influenced his activity. Maybe he didn't do it. Maybe it was the algorithms, they say. Always blame the algorithms. They also argue that some data can be taken out of context. Well, sure, he was on the internet. Well, sure, he likes knives. Of course, he has a history that he enjoys knives. What's wrong with that? These are classic e-discovery disputes, just in a criminal wrapper. Was data collected lawfully? Was anything lost, deleted, or altered? Did investigators follow proper protocols and minimize over-collection? Were privacy rights or statutory protections violated in the process? e-discovery isn't just a civil litigation or internal investigation tool. It's a discipline that protects the integrity of evidence.
All right, now let's talk about kind of my final takeaway here and why this matters so much for e-discovery professionals is that authenticity, reliability, and relevance, they still rule the day. You know, even in a criminal case, in a corporate investigation, those are such pillars of the e-discovery profession. And that's because for evidence, including digital evidence and metadata, to be admitted in court, it must pass basic evidentiary thresholds. It has to be authentic. We have to be able to prove that this data is what it purports to be. It has to be reliable. You have to show that it was collected in a forensically sound manner and with appropriate tools and protocols. And it has to be relevant. It has to have a tendency to make a fact more or less probable. In this case, each layer of it, from the DNA sample to the phone data on the Amazon clickstream, had to be supported by metadata, logs, and chain of custody reports. And that's really where the e-discovery professionals shine, ensuring that data is preserved, collected, and produced in ways that withstand judicial scrutiny, so that we can catch killers like Koberger and bring justice to those victims.
Amen, sister.
Whoop. All right. I think that brings us to the end of our episode. Thank you so much for joining us on eDiscovery Chicks. We hope you learned something new, felt empowered, or just had some fun along the way. And don't forget to join the flock by following us on LinkedIn and Instagram, and check out our website, ediscoverychicks.com. If you loved this episode, share it with your network, leave us a review, or tag us on your socials with your favorite takeaway. And don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts so you never miss an episode. Catch us next time. Until then, flock on, friends.
The views we've expressed today are the eDiscovery Chicks views and don't necessarily represent the views of our employers, partners, or clients. This podcast is available solely for educational purposes to provide general information about eDiscovery principles and not to provide legal advice to any specific situation. It's not a substitute for legal advice from a lawyer you've retained and who has agreed to represent you.